This week, a gun threat at a Des Moines middle school caused a lockdown. Some praised the quick action taken by school leaders. Others raised questions about the district's security and communication. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's our Friday News Buzz edition of River to River, an hour of quick conversations about several Iowa news stories this week. Also this hour, how copper theft is quickly spreading throughout the state, a contentious debate in Iowa City over a possible repeal of the 21-only ordinance, which prevents those under 21 from being in bars after 10 p.m., and we check in with the Iowa State Patrol to find out why they may switch from sedans to SUVs. Buckle up for the News Buzz right after this national news from NPR. It's River to River, River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and we've arrived at a Friday News Buzz edition of our program. We like to collect quick conversations about news during the week, Iowa stories during the week. We're going to buzz through about a half dozen stories this hour, including how copper theft is quickly spreading throughout the state. It's costing taxpayers tens of thousands of dollars. And in a few moments, the contentious debate in Iowa City over a possible rollback of the 21 ordinance. That's an ordinance that has existed since 2010, which prevents those under 21 from being in bars after 10 p.m. And at the end of the program, we'll check in with the Iowa State Patrol to find out why they may switch from sedans to SUVs. Also, some really interesting new technology, GPS projectile technology they have on at least one patrol car that assists in car chases. We'll find out about that from the Iowa State Patrol at the end of the hour. But first, Merrill Middle School students in Des Moines returned to class on Wednesday after a gun threat on Tuesday that led to a lockdown. Some pretty tense moments for family members. Joining me to talk about what happened this week on Tuesday, Alex Hanna is principal at Merrill Middle School. Hey. Welcome to our program, and tell us, what happened on Tuesday? What was the threat?
Well, on Tuesday, we had an incident involving two adults that came into our building and have some ties to a child here in our building, and they got into a disagreement, argument. I was called out to the front desk, and evidently there were some threats that were made, which really warranted us to initiate our full emergency lockdown procedures at Merrill.
What was the nature of the threat?
There was the nature of the threat, and I don't want to get too involved in the details of it because there's still some possible litigation that may take place here. But it was enough to have us do the lockdown in terms of violence or the threat of a gun, the threat of shooting.
What was the person who made the threat armed?
I really would not want to get into that, but I can tell you at this point, by the time that the officers and law enforcement apprehended him, we do know that he didn't have a weapon at that time.
Did not at the time of apprehension. Okay.
Right.
I think we're getting the picture. So when you go into lockdown, what's the procedure?
Oh, it's a pretty pretty quick and intense procedure. It has to do with job one, making sure that all staff and students are moved to a safe location. Probably the first would be in their classrooms or a designated area to make sure that we secure safety for our students and staff. And then at that point, we do some, calling of Des Moines Police Department, our Des Moines security. And then we just got a checklist that we go down through. We initiate what we call a response, emergency readiness response team in our building, which consists of a number of teachers and staff, and they have a role to do. And we just go right down the list and in terms of what they need to do and what needs to take place during the process.
So your staff had practiced drills. There was not any question of what procedure to follow here.
Right. There was not. When we initiated the full lockdown procedures, we know exactly what to do, and we have been practicing drills. Obviously, in the aftermath of the school shootings that have taken place across the country, so our district has been real intentional
Yep.
In terms of sharing with us what we need to do. So we do a monthly, what we refer to as a lockdown drill.
So if I can picture this, most students would have been with a teacher or teachers in a classroom, huddled in a classroom, in a locked classroom to lock down?
That's correct. That's correct.
Now, I understand that some of the concern after this, and you know, you can always improve, I imagine, by practice here. Some of the concern is that the threat had been removed from the building, and students and staff and teachers did not know that the threat had been removed. Is that something you can improve upon?
Yes, but at the time the threat was removed from the building, the threat was still in our area, and we stayed in close communications with Des Moines Police Department and Des Moines public school system security, and we know that the threat had exited the building but had not been apprehended, which then it's kind of a principal's call whether or not to do that, but we were still in full lockdown.
Right.
Because the threat was still pretty prevalent.
You wanted to make sure you erred on the side of safety, if you would.
Well, I mean, the protocol in that situation for me would be he has not been apprehended. He left our building. We put on a lockdown. So we want to make sure that he's apprehended because there is a possibility for re-entering our building at some point. There would be a possibility of that happening prior to him being apprehended. And the thing that concerns me in that respect is, and until that happens, I'm going to have the safety of our students and staff at the forefront.
We've got just a minute left. Principal sure. Hannah, what would you say are the lessons that you have learned if this, God forbid, would happen again in the next few weeks? What would you do differently?
Probably we would make sure that we continue to work with our students and staff, and probably work with our parents. We have a scheduled meeting for our parents because we know that we had done extremely well with training our students and training our staff on the lockdown drills in the event that an incident like this occurred. But we're not sure if we did an adequate job with parents.
Communicating to them what was happening, you mean?
No, not really. Communicating what the drill consists of. When we go into a lockdown drill, even if you are as a parent standing outside of our door, you can't get in. And I'm not sure parents really understand that. We want to educate them on that. But we do want to communicate with parents. But we want to make sure that the first and foremost efforts that we put forth is the safety of the kids in our building and the staff in our building. And then the communication can flow accordingly.
Okay. Principal Alex Hanna of Merrill Middle School in Des Moines, I want to thank you very much. And
can I just say this just very
yes.
quickly? At the end of the day, you know, all the T's may not be crossed and all the I's may not be dotted, but one of the things that we're really extremely pleased with, everybody gets to go home and be with loved ones.
Right you are. Alex Hanna, thank you for joining us this hour.
You bet. All right. Thank you.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Stay away. Copperhead Town.
Native Iowa singer-songwriter Dick Prawl there, some original music, Copperhead Town, featuring lyrics with a nod to the element in our next story. By the way, I see that Dick Prawl is performing tonight at the Mill in Iowa City. Copper theft has been hitting Iowa's electric utilities hard, and now they are fighting back with a tool that's long been used to catch killers and other criminals. Joining us, Ethan Hohennadel is a data analyst at the Iowa Association of Electrical Cooperatives. Ethan, are you there?
I am. Good morning, Ben.
Good afternoon. We're just into the afternoon hours, so I'll forgive you on that one. Let's see. What's been happening to copper?
Well, unfortunately, with the price of copper, it's become a pretty big target for thieves, not only in the state of Iowa, but across the country.
Okay. And so specifically when it has to do with electrical cooperatives, what people you represent, what's been happening?
Well, we've had numerous different types of incidents where either grounds or transformers, various items are being stolen from substations and off of power lines and that kind of stuff. And it's very not only costly, but then also dangerous in when thieves are getting into places, stealing grounds and so forth. So, you know, we had an incident recently where a number of grounds were stolen at a substation. And because those grounds aren't there, the electricity needs somewhere to ground, and so it finds its path of least resistance. And that's not always predictable. So when crews go out to try and repair these types of issues, they sometimes come show up in a situation where they're not sure what's happening, what's been stolen, and they have to try and identify that. So that causes problems in that safety area. Those substations need to be shut down, can cause interruptions with electric service and on down the line.
I have a feeling we're not dealing with amateurs because it sounds like to me copper wire carrying electricity could have thousands of volts. They're risking their lives?
Yes, yes, they are. There have been the various crimes that have happened. Some of them seem to, the people who have done it seem to have at least a general knowledge of what's there. Some of them may just be getting lucky at the same time. So it's a very, I guess, dangerous proposition, especially on their end. We had one incident here in Iowa that affected a cooperative that the thieves stole roughly 15 to 20 foot of copper wire, which at the $3 a pound roughly that it's been going for recently, you're talking probably $50 worth of value. They ended up doing almost $50,000 worth of damage to the substation on top of what they stole. So they're risking their lives and damaging lots of equipment for a small payday.
What are your guesses on who these people are?
That's a good question. There haven't been a lot of apprehensions in the copper thieves, to my knowledge. And part of that problem is on the substations or where they're getting these, they're really targeting things that are kind of out of the public eye. They're easy to hide, easy to get around. I'm not sure why these guys are doing it or what it really kind of drives them to do so, but it seems to be a fairly popular activity across the country.
Yeah, and I see also the Iowa DOT is looking for the public's help in ending the thefts from their area, the highway along the highway system. I think the I-29 corridor, also in Council Bluffs, dealing with theft of copper wiring from roadway lights. In your case, what is this costing? Who is this costing money? How much is it costing?
As far as the total dollar amount, I don't have that in front of me. But the big key is at the end of the day, it ends up costing the electric ratepayers in Iowa more because for every damage or every theft that happens, that system needs to be repaired and replaced. And at the end of the day, that money ends up coming through on your electric bills. So whether you're served by an electric cooperative or you're served by Mid-American Energy or Lion Energy or a municipal utility, at the end of the day, that money ends up flowing down into those bills. And so anything we can do to help stop and or prevent copper theft really helps keep the electric rates as low as possible, which is why the electric utilities in Iowa have joined together and developed a Crime Stoppers 800 number that can be used for any copper thefts across the state. So they don't have to worry about if they're calling the right number or should they contact, you know, the authorities, that kind of stuff. They can always contact their local authorities to report the crime. But if they're looking for an anonymous way to report a copper theft that they find in their local communities, they can call that 800 number, and the proper utility will get the information.
The number is 800-452-1111. Four ones there at the end. 800-452-four ones following that. How would we recognize copper theft? We have just a few seconds left, but suspicious activity, behavior, where?
If you notice people kind of mulling around, if you have a substation near you, a transformer on a pole, that kind of stuff, if it's a utility worker, they're probably going to have a proper safety equipment on, a hard hat, gloves, so forth. They're also probably going to be driving a utility truck, so it's going to have the utility's name on the side, that kind of stuff. If you see people, you know, that are you know, roaming around substations or are messing on power poles, that kind of stuff, that don't have that level of equipment, that's probably something a little suspicious. Okay. And just because the linemen that work for the electric utilities are very, very conscious of safety, and so they take extra precautions to make sure that when they're working with it, they're doing the proper things.
I understand that there's a possible reward for if people are apprehended because of a tip-off to 800-452-1111, maximum of $1,000 reward.
That is correct.
Okay. Ethan Hohennadel, data analyst at the Iowa Association of Electrical Cooperatives, thank you for informing us here.
Oh, thank you very much.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, and buzzing through a few news stories we didn't get to earlier this week. The Iowa City Downtown District has experienced a number of changes in the past 3 years. There's some renovations if you visited the downtown area, some construction of high-rise buildings, and also, as we've reported in the news from time to time, implementation of several controversial ordinances. Now, the 21 ordinance established in 2010 prohibits people under the age of 21 from being in bars after 10 p.m. Several establishments, though, and some restaurants and music venues are exempted from this. Now the law hitting its third year. It's a contentious debate going on in Iowa City over the possible rollback of the 21 ordinance. Here to fill us in on that, Zach Tilley, University of Iowa senior, opinions editor for the Daily Iowan, which is a student-run newspaper for the campus of the University of Iowa. Zach Tilley, welcome to our program.
Good to be here.
You were a moderator for a forum on Wednesday of this week looked at the arguments yes and no. Yes would be to roll back this ordinance, and no would be to keep it in place. How would you characterize the debate? What happened?
I would say the debate was more or less it was contentious at times. It got a little testy. The yes campaign brought a lot of their crowd along, and they were a little rowdy.
What points was the Yes campaign? Is that they're the people who want to change this? What were they making the points?
So they're in favor of a repeal, obviously, and the crux of their argument is that as adults, as 19 and 20-year-olds, they believe that a fundamental right, a fundamental freedom has been taken away from them, their right to be in bars after 10 p.m. They also make the point that the ordinance has somehow compromised student safety by forcing their drinking from the bar scene out into house parties in town, which they have characterized as being less safe than mm-hmm. being downtown.
Did they have some data to back up their arguments?
They do. They point to a modest increase in the number of disorderly house citations. They also point to a citywide increase in the incidence of ambulance calls. Over the last few years, those have fallen downtown but increased in other parts of town, and they look at that as evidence that perhaps injuries relating to parties and drinking have sort of radiated out into the community from their central point downtown.
What about the no people? What have they argued? They want to keep this 21 ordinance in place.
So they argue generally that the 21 ordinance has been a benefit to downtown Iowa City and also has contributed to a decline in binge drinking among university students. They point to what they usually characterize as a more vibrant, diverse downtown, an increasingly diverse business community.
Past that, any other data?
Yes. So the city issued a report earlier this month looking at crime trends between 2010 and 2013, and their conclusion was that assaults, sexual assaults, basically every type of crime except theft has fallen downtown
Paula's,
in that time period.
Paula's and OWIs?
Paula's and OWIs in particular, although there was another study from some undergraduates at the University of Iowa that looked at some of these trends and found that they may have been in place regardless of whether the 21 ordinance was in place or not. So the statistics start to get a little fuzzy when you dig into them.
We have a little clip of the mayor of Iowa City, Matt Hayek. He is also the co-chair of 21 Makes Sense. He's a no lobbying for the no side of this, and our own IPR's Duri Buscarin spoke with him on the day of the forum that you moderated, Zach Tilley. And in this clip, he's explaining why he's nervous about this repeal being voted in.
In 2010, The referendum was also tied to a congressional and a gubernatorial race, and so you had more people voting because of more things being on the ballot. In 2013, all we have is a city council election with this 21-only referendum. So I'm predicting a lower voter turnout by the general community. And so I'm quite nervous that, the community will be asleep on this and will not pay attention to the gravity of the situation, and that we could see a reversal of this ordinance.
Mayor Hayek there saying the community might be asleep. He's fearful of that. I guess by the community, he's saying the over 21 community. Are the students awake? Are they going to repeal this, Zach Tilley, you think?
I think there's definitely been a significant change in student engagement between when this ordinance was last debated in 2010 and today. I think it honestly has a lot to do with the fact that over the last 3 years, most of the student population has turned over, and most of the undergraduates at Iowa have never lived in an Iowa city with 19-only bars. And so the issue has kind of lost salience among students, I think. There are certainly a very vocal but relatively small minority who is campaigning hard for this. But generally speaking, I think there's less buzz among students than there was 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. And so I understand Mayor Hayek's concerns about turnout, but I also think that the most motivated constituents from 2010 in opposition to the 21 ordinance have also lost some steam in the intervening years as well.
Bar owners were very much opposed to this in 2010. Have their views changed? Have they adapted their business model to this 21 ordinance in the meantime?
Some have and some haven't. The current effort to repeal the 21 ordinance came after a petition filed by two bar owners, or one bar owner and a bar manager, I believe. But elsewhere, there are bar owners who have adapted, who believe that a return to 19-only would hurt their business model. And so there's no unanimity among bar owners, as far as I can tell. Some have been harmed, some have been helped, and so it's kind of split.
If you had to make a prediction, what would you say? Who's going to will the ordinance stay?
I think it will. I do think turnout will be relatively small. But I feel like the opposition is not as engaged as it was in 2010. In 2010, you had a lot of pretty substantial concerns in the community about, you know, neighborhoods exploding with parties, and that really hasn't happened.
Okay, Zach Tilley, thank you for cluing us in on this. University of Iowa senior opinions editor for the Daily Iowan, moderator for Forum on Wednesday about the controversy in Iowa City. The debate over the possible repeal of the 21 ordinance, which prevents those under 21 from being in bars after 10 p.m. Zach Tilley, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Coming up in just a moment, we'll talk with a reporter from Harvest Public Media about two rural communities whose children are living in the shadows of two Tyson slaughterhouses. Also coming up in just a moment, we check in with the Iowa State Patrol to find out why they may switch from sedans to SUVs. Also, some fascinating new GPS projectile technology to assist in car chases, and why, if you have out-of-state plates, you're more likely to be pulled over by the Iowa State Patrol. We'll get an explanation for that when we return. This is a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. So good to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Monday on this program, well, the TSA, we've heard in our news this week, now says some travelers won't have to remove their shoes, belts, or jackets while going through airport security. Also, the FAA expanding the use of electronic devices on board. We'll look at these changes, what they mean for air travel on Monday. Also, the importance of correctly navigating your way through dining etiquette in professional settings. That's also on Monday. It's our NewsBuzz edition today, a Friday NewsBuzz edition of our program. And coming up in just a few minutes, we'll check in with the Iowa State Patrol to find out why they may switch from sedans to SUVs. Also, find out about a new type of technology, a projectile technology that relies on GPS and assists in car chases. But first of all, Immigrants have always been the backbone of America's meatpacking plants, and now we want to talk with a reporter from Harvest Public Media about a series of reports, you may have heard them here on Iowa Public Radio, about two rural communities whose children are living in the shadows of two Tyson slaughterhouses. Abby Fentress Swanson joins us, Harvest Public Media reporter with KBIA in Mid-Missouri with Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Abby, are you there?
Yep, I'm here. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Abby. Great to have you with us. I understand this series has helped along with funding from the Institute for Justice and Journalism's Immigration in the Heartland Fellowship. So tell us more about what you looked at in this series. And we want to mention that those who didn't hear all of the series can go to harvestpublicmedia.org and find the podcasts.
Yeah, so it's all online. And along with my colleague Peggy Lowe in Kansas City, we both did these stories that focused on immigrant children and immigrant and refugee children whose parents worked at slaughterhouses. I went to Knoll, Missouri, which is a tiny town in southwest Missouri, and she was in Garden City, Kansas. And I went to Knoll for 4 days and talked to immigrants, refugees, and their children, all about kind of starting life anew in this very rural, remote town while making wages that started around $9 an hour.
So what did you find? What opened your eyes in that experience in Knoll, Missouri?
I mean, the main thing that I found is you have an extremely diverse population right in the heart of the Ozarks in a tiny little town. And a lot of these workers, while the wages are pretty good for rural Missouri at around $9 an hour, we found that the poverty rates were really high there. About 90% of these kids were on reduced or free school meals. And the problem is the nearest food bank is miles away, as well as the nearest free clinic. So basically schools are kind of becoming the de facto safety net in the town that I looked at in Knoll. And there are lots of meatpacking towns like this across the country.
Mm-hmm. We have a little bit of audio from that you collected in Knoll, too, from a couple clips from Angie Brewer. Tell us about that, one of those clips, and we'll listen.
Yeah, so she was one of the principals I talked to at Knoll Elementary, and she's actually grew up in McDonald County, which is where Knoll is, and went to the high school there, graduated in 1992, and back then it was an all-white county, and now it's majority minority, if you will, mostly Hispanics, Somalis, and Burmese immigrants who are all now working at the plant.
Mm-hmm. Let's listen to this clip. There's a little bit of a translator here at the beginning. Then we'll hear Angie Brewer of Knoll Primary School and talking about the aspect you just mentioned there, that schools now being really a safety net for these children who live in this area in Missouri and Knoll.
Yep. We are the government agency in town. People come here if they need shoes, if they need clothes, if they're hungry. We send 37 backpacks home every weekend with kids that just don't have enough food.
Mm-hmm. So also another clip from Angie Brewer here. Let's play this one because I think this really demonstrates that tugs a little bit at the heartstrings. Tell us before we listen to this, she's quite dedicated and emotional when she talks about helping these children.
Yeah, I mean, I really do think, you know, this was a great example of how everyone working at these schools, they're really doing everything they can to help these kids, whether it's English language instruction, whether it's helping with kids whose parents have been deported in the middle of the night, to, like, as she said, sending backpacks full of food home, helping kids who are sick. And in this cut, she's going to talk about how dedicated she is to all of her students here.
Angie Brewer of Knoll Elementary.
No one's going to fall through a crack in Knoll, Missouri. It's not going to happen. I mean, some of these are my own children's friends, and these are my friends. They're real people, and they deserve the best.
Did you get a chance, Abby, to meet with the family, see how these kids are, see how these kids live differently than people here in Iowa or other parts of the Midwest, what we like to think of as a happy childhood in the Midwest?
Yeah, I mean, I hung out with a lot of families while I was there. And I would say mostly the kids themselves seem pretty happy to be there. I mean, I think kids are very resilient. And so I think in general, they felt happy to be in Knoll. But the real thing that I took away from doing this story is just how hard the community is working to try to get these kids services that they need. And that's where the schools were kind of coming into play. And the parents are the ones who are doing like this hard, you know, serious backbreaking work in the poultry plant there. All of the kids I talked to, kind of the older they get, all of them said that they will not be working in the slaughterhouse later in life. And they hope for a future that doesn't include that. And the parents echoed that sentiment as well. They said, you know, we're doing this hard work so our kids can have a better future.
Now, when we say immigrant workers, are these documented? Do we know that does the government, does the state know how many of these workers there are or how many of the children there are?
No, and that was really surprising to us. I mean, I did talk to undocumented kids, and of course the refugee kids do have a ready path to legal citizenship. But it was really surprising to me and to my colleague Peggy that this sort of group, this population of kids is really an invisible population. No one, I mean, we must have called between the two of us probably 24 federal agencies, researchers, advocacy groups, unions, trying to kind of track this number of kids, and no one's really following them. And that was really kind of shocking to both of us, because this is, you know, these kids will be contributing to our economy. They're our future. And yet no one really is checking in on them.
Right. And immigration legislation stalled in Washington, a bill through the Senate, but the budget fights in Washington pushing the immigration bill, Congress not addressing that with all the budgetary fights. Was that a topic of conversation in what you found in your reporting?
I think, you know, issues of immigration were on the radar at both the primary school, which is really young kids, and also at the elementary school. I mean, they talk about the DREAM Act. They talk about deferred action status because these are parts of their parents' lives. They're parts of these kids' lives, and they're parts of the school now. And it's really shocking to see this in a community that 20 years ago was like all white, and all of it's happening because of the Tyson plant. So yeah, kids are definitely aware of it. And of course, high schoolers, especially undocumented high schoolers, are trying to figure out how they can stay in this country after graduation and go to college. And one way they can do that is by applying for deferred action, which allows them to legally stay for 2 years. But then it's kind of a question mark after that.
Abby, where does the reporting in this area go from here? Do you continue that with more reporting, follow-up?
Yeah, you know, we don't know what we're going to do next. I have received a lot of calls from the small, tiny community of Knoll. Some people saying, we're pleased that you spent time here. Other people saying, well, you didn't represent our community as you should have. There was one diner in town, which is called Kathy's Country Kitchen with all K's, and inside they have a T-shirt that says, I got caught eating at the KKK, and I had been told by Somali workers that they didn't feel welcome there. And so I've gotten a lot of emails, both from the owner of that diner and also from residents who say, you know, we don't have a problem with the Somalis at all. We try to be as welcoming as possible. But I think this is just a sign of, you know, how tense it can be when populations change so quickly, especially in these small rural towns.
Yeah, I guess a number of people probably have a little problem with that slogan.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think if you put that to a test group, pretty many thumbs down to that. But anyway, to each his own, if you're running a business, I guess, huh?
Yeah, it's been a fascinating place to report. And yeah, I'd love to check in with them and see how they're doing down the line.
Okay, Abby Fentress Swanson of Harvest Public Media with KBIA, Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Thank you for telling us about this series. The final piece airing this today on Iowa Public Radio, but no worries, you can listen to all of them or download them as podcasts. Find out more information about this series at harvestpublicmedia.org. Abby, thanks so much for stopping by.
My pleasure. Thanks, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and today, finally, we end up with several bits of news connected with the Iowa State Patrol. And joining us to talk about those, Sergeant Scott Bright of the Iowa State Patrol. Hi, Scott. Sergeant Bright.
Hey, Ben, how are you?
I am fine. I am doing well. Are we getting some sun? I haven't been out of the studio. Are we getting some sun out there finally?
Actually, I just came in from outside, and actually, we're getting some warmth here in Des Moines, so the sun is coming out, and it's looking better.
All right. Let's talk about the possible change, considering converting up to half of the, what I understand is a 380-car fleet from sedans to SUVs. What prompted this thought to possibly change?
Yeah, currently we're looking at the Ford Explorer. We currently have two that are in our fleet. We're just kind of demonstrating those and seeing how they handle. We're looking at the price of them and just to see how they handle out there on the roadway. Currently we have the Dodge Charger. We're kind of looking at this other vehicle, just the technology. And, I mean, there's so many improvements in vehicles over the years, and we just want to make the right choice for our department.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the considerations you're making when you, I suppose, you have a pro-con list of making the switch? What are some of the factors?
Well, I think they look at the price, first of all, and they look at safety features of the vehicle. And, you know, these vehicles are basically the trooper's office. A trooper will spend 9 hours a day in this vehicle. So they have to look at if the vehicle's comfortable. They'll look at other issues, you know, how much room it has in the trunk, or like the SUV has a back area where they can put stuff. We do carry a lot of stuff in our vehicles, and that's one of the concerns that we have to look at is how big the vehicle is, how they perform, and just look at the safety ratings that they have.
Mm-hmm. So, and it's this SUV, this Explorer, a much larger interior. Are you getting, as Iowa State Patrol, patrolmen, patrolwomen, getting more and more equipment over the years? What is in one of these cars?
Well, I think over the years we have, you know, increased in our equipment. Years ago, I've been on the force going on 24 years now, and back when I first started, we never had computers in our squad cars. So now we have a computer in our squad car, which takes up a little bit more space, and the radios, and, you know, we have radars in there, we have video cameras. So their technology, as it's improving, is taking up a lot more space in our vehicles compared to years ago.
And I suppose with an SUV, do you have better off-road capabilities or snow capabilities?
Actually, SUVs, they sit a little bit higher, so we're going to have a little bit more clearance between the ground and the vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, especially during the snowy season that we have around the state of Iowa, it's going to improve us possibly getting to somebody where we might not be able to get there with a Dodge Charger, since it's a little bit lower to the ground.
A little worse gas mileage with the Explorer versus the, the Challenger?
Actually, it's a Dodge Charger. It's
Charger.
Pretty comparable to the Explorer. The price is about $700 difference, $700 more for the Explorer. So there's really not much of a price difference. So we're just testing these two vehicles out, and then, you know, the command staff will make a decision on which way to go.
What is it going forward? What stage are you in the decision-making process?
Actually, we just received the two vehicles here within the last week or so. They're getting them outfitted, and they will put them out to the road. They'll pick two troopers around the state to test those vehicles. I get their recommendations, and then, you know, the command staff will sit down and decide which way they're going to head.
Mm-hmm. Do you pay attention to what other states are doing in this way?
We communicate with other states to see, you know, if they do have the Explorers, you know, how they respond and how they, you know, handle out there on the roadway. So we communicate with other states to see what kind of vehicles they're going to. You know, in Iowa, we get a lot of snow, so some states are a little bit different. You know, you have states down south where, you know, some of their squad cars are Camaros or Ford Mustang GTs, and that's not a vehicle that we can use all year round up here. So, you know, we have to communicate with the states that surround Iowa to try to get a feel of what, you know, departments are using.
Sergeant Scott Bright is with us of the Iowa State Patrol, touching on a few news issues associated with the Iowa State Patrol. Sergeant Bright, I understand, considering also some new GPS projectile technology to assist in car chases. What is this?
Well, actually, it's something that, you know, we've done a few news stories on, and people think it's from a Batman movie. But
exactly.
What it is, it's installed in the front grille of one of our squad cars, and it shoots a projectile out. And once the projectile is shot out from the vehicle, it'll adhere to the vehicle that you're trying to stop. And in that projectile has a GPS device. So if a trooper tries to make a vehicle stop and the person decides not to stop, then, you know, if we have this projectile, he can shoot that out from his vehicle. He can back off from the pursuit, which we're looking at it for liability purposes. It saves damages to squad cars, life, you know, somebody that's innocent out there if a pursuit is started. And basically we can get that projectile on the vehicle and we can follow that vehicle on our computer in our squad car and go exactly to where that individual is.
Describe the projectile. Is it a hard projectile or a gooey thing that sticks? What is it?
It's a gluey adhesive to the front of it, and the projectile is approximately, I'd say, about 4 or 5 inches long.
It's like a dart, maybe.
Yes, exactly. And it'll projectile out from the squad car, and it'll attach to the back of the vehicle, and that projectile has a GPS device,
right.
And we can get on from our car, or, you know, our state radio dispatch can actually get on their computer and actually follow the car and inform us where that vehicle is headed.
Mm-hmm. So I suppose if you're following this car and they have giving you the signals, they're not going to slow down or stop, and you're in a chase. Do you have to be a pretty good aim with this, or does it? It's not heat seeking or anything, is it?
No. Actually, what it is, the trooper inside has the capability of where to aim the projectile. It kind of has an up and down movement, and it'll shoot out a green laser, and actually kind of show you where it will hit on the vehicle if you do shoot it at that time. Right. So it's kind of has like a little sight on it. You shoot the projectile, and it'll land probably within a 6-inch area of where that green dot was showing on that vehicle.
Will the person being pursued know that it hit the car? Is there a thud or anything?
There is a little bit of a thud, but, you know, when if an officer is in pursuit of a vehicle, you know, with the lights going, the sirens going, the person's taken off for a reason, so right. Their adrenaline is pumping. And, you know, they're probably not going to be aware that it's actually on their vehicle.
Right. And if they were, it's not like they're going to stop and try to find it and pull it off. Right.
No, exactly. You know, and if a lot of people have asked the question, well, if, you know, they get out of the vehicle and leave the vehicle, well, you know, the most important part is we got the vehicle back. Maybe the vehicle has been stolen.
Right.
And, you know, we can further our investigation from that. But just in the last week, the officer that has this system in his vehicle has deployed it twice, and we have made successful arrests in both cases.
Wow.
We have not had any damage with any vehicles, any squad cars. So it's just in the last week, it's been very effective for our department.
How many chases on average do you have, high-speed chases involving the Iowa State Patrol?
Well, actually, I just ran the statistics here. From October 25th last year until October 25th this year, the State Patrol had 87 pursuits around the state.
Mm-hmm. And any other further data on how they ended?
No, I'm not sure how they ended.
Okay.
You know, it's
that's a good number of pursuits, and all right.
Yeah, for our state, and you know, we try to get the message out that law enforcement, being in law enforcement, we do not initiate the pursuit. We try to make a traffic stop. It's the person that's driving that vehicle. They are the ones that initiate the pursuits, and we're looking at it with a device like this that we can back off, we can follow the GPS wherever they're going, and we could save, you know, lives. We can say property damage from our vehicles, and we don't want anybody innocent out there getting hurt or killed because of a pursuit.
Sergeant Bright of the Iowa State Patrol, we had last week on our program Lee Rude, Des Moines Register's Reader's Watchdog column writer, talking about the data that the Des Moines Register in this column reviewed. State troopers pulling over cars found out that out-of-state motorists far more likely than Iowans to be pulled over by state troopers, something like 86% went to out-of-state motorists. What's your reaction to the column in the Des Moines Register?
Well, when you look at that statistic, I mean, you have to know the background of that statistic. Basically, the information that she pulled from that article is that 86%, this is a criminal interdiction team, which consists of 10 troopers across the state. This is not the whole Iowa State Patrol. This is just a team of 10 members that are out there looking for criminal activity going across our interstates, whether it's, you know, the traffic safety, drug trafficking, weapons trafficking, human trafficking. Trafficking is becoming bigger. And we have a team of 10 individuals out there that are working the interstate. And to see a statistic that 86% that we are focusing on of out-of-state drivers is not true at all.
Mm-hmm. In what way is that not fair, though, when we put that out there? Because in a certain sense, it is fair, according to the data that they drew on, right?
Well, actually, Iowa has 14%, so that's where they came up with that statistic. The vehicles that are stopped out there, 14% were Iowa. Below us was 13% was California, and I believe it was Illinois, Colorado was the next state at 11%. So it's, if you look at statistics, it's all around. There's different states around. And, you know, people need to understand that this criminal interdiction team out there, after the rush hour traffic in Iowa, there is not many Iowa cars on the Iowa interstates.
Okay, so we're just being driven through here.
A lot of people are driving through, exactly, because, you know, you look at Interstate 80, it runs from the West Coast to the East Coast. And when you see a statistic like that, this is only concerning the interdiction team. So, I mean, you can kind of look at it, maybe it was misunderstood and how much percentage, but we look at the success of this criminal interdiction team over the four-year period that, you know, she wrote her article on. And, I mean, this wasn't mentioned in the article, but just in the last 4 years with this criminal interdiction team on our interstates, we have seized over 3,400 pounds of marijuana. We've had 33 pounds of methamphetamines. Over 215 pounds of cocaine have been seized off the interstates, just Interstate 80 coming across through our state. So the success rate has been phenomenal.
We've got less than a minute. Yesterday, I understand an armed 25-year-old wanted for murder a warrant in from Georgia captured in western Iowa by Iowa State Patrol troopers. What else can you tell us about that in 30 seconds?
Actually, yeah, we got a call from the Georgia dispatch. They were had aware that this vehicle was crossing over into Iowa from the Missouri border. We put some troopers out there on the interstate, and one of our troopers actually located the vehicle, waited for backup, and made a felony stop, and basically took that individual into custody without incident. So it was a great stop for those troopers, and within 24 hours, we had a murder suspect in custody.
Sergeant Scott Bright of the Iowa State Patrol, thank you for spending these few minutes updating us on several aspects of the work that you do in our state. Thank you very much.
I appreciate that. Thanks for the time.
Thank you. Brings an end to this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, a News Buzz edition. Monday on this program, stay tuned. We'll talk about air travel. Perhaps you're going to be traveling in the holidays. TSA now saying that some travelers won't have to remove their shoes, belts, or jackets. Also, perhaps you can leave that iPad or what are they called, Surface, on while you're taking off. We'll find out about that on Monday on this program. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a great weekend. ¶¶